We approach the final decades of life with some wariness. We know bodies and brains reach their limits, but the possibility of a long decline or disability is not something we like to consider. We'll spend this hour talking about one of the great neurological concerns as we age, and perhaps not the one you might think of first. We all dread Alzheimer's disease, but our focus this hour is Parkinson's disease, which includes symptoms like tremors, slow movements, stiffness, and issues with balance. Our guests are two of the four authors of Ending Parkinson's Disease, A Prescription for Action. The authors altogether, Ray Dorsey, Todd Shearer, Michael Oken, and Bastian Blome. Our guests are Ray Dorsey and Michael Oken. Ray Dorsey is professor of neurology at the University of Rochester, former director of the Parkinson's Division at Johns Hopkins University. Welcome, Dr. Ray.
Thank you very much for having me, Jeffrey. Just call me Ray.
Sure. And Michael Oken, professor of neurology at the University of Florida and national medical director of the Parkinson's Foundation. Welcome to you, Michael.
Well, it's great to be here. You can call me Michael as well.
All right, thanks. So, Ray, you address one of my suspicions in the second paragraph, the belief that Alzheimer's is the number one neurological disorder, but you say not so?
Yeah, so it turns out that the fastest growing brain disease in the world is not Alzheimer's disease, it's Parkinson's disease. The number of people affected by the disease has more than doubled in the last 25 years, and if we don't change our course, it'll double again in the coming 25. Today, 200 Americans will be diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, and 100 will die from the condition.
And is this a change? I mean, is it growing faster now than it used to?
Yeah, so when Dr. Parkinson described the condition in London in 1817, it was likely a very rare disorder. In fact, he only described six people with the disease. Today, it is no longer rare. The number of Americans with the disease has increased 35% in just the last 10 years.
Is living longer part of the reason?
Yeah, so living longer is part of the reason. Many chronic diseases have an increasing incidence with age, but it's not enough to explain the rise. There are other environmental factors that are likely playing a role. These factors are tied to the Industrial Revolution and include certain pesticides, industrial chemicals, and air pollution, which is a big issue in Oregon.
And Michael Oken, let's talk about the issues with Parkinson's. Tremors, slow movements, stiffness, issues with balance, we mentioned. Are there some others as well?
Yeah, so it turns out that Parkinson has been referred to by many experts as the most complex disease in medicine, period. And you're going to say, oh my, how can you say that? I mean, that just seems too outlandish, but you know, this is a disorder that has not only tremor, stiffness, slowness, and what we call the motor symptoms. And by the way, 20%, one in five, don't have a tremor with Parkinson's, and that should blow a few people's minds. But also non-motor symptoms, depression, anxiety, apathy. And when you put that together and you also think about how you can give these folks dopamine and they wake up or they have an awakening and a lot of these symptoms improve, and then you can do surgeries like deep brain stimulation, and it becomes very complicated very quickly. And so we like to highlight that it's not just a disorder of dopamine and it's not just a disorder of motor symptoms like tremor. There are a whole bunch of symptoms and a really complex group of presentations, and that's why it can be so confusing to the public, because a lot of our Parkinson folks just look different when they're side by side.
Well, you have already alluded to the lack of dopamine in the brain. Let's talk about what we believe to be the basic mechanism of Parkinson's disease, what it affects, and how.
Yeah, so, you know, when we think about, you know, what causes Parkinson, this is, you know, sort of that Nobel-level question where we're trying to decide, you know, what is setting off what is in essence a degenerative process in the brain. And when I say a degenerative process for people who are listening, I'm talking about cells and cells that are connected between each other. So those are the circuits that have pipes between them. And I'm talking about when those circuits go bad because cells start dying or they become dysfunctioned in some way that the brain can't carry out its normal tasks. And so it begins to get these, what we call plaques. So you get plaques on your teeth, but you can get plaques on the brain as well. And these plaques are made of a substance called alpha-synuclein. And so you get these plaques that appear in different areas of the brain. And depending on which area of the brain these plaques appear, that's where you get the symptoms. Now, one other point is that because it's easy to point
point to dopamine, and dopamine is such an important chemical to Parkinson. And because there is disease in that area of the brain, there are these black cells. Dopamine is black in the brain. In fact, we call it the black substance where it lives, or in Latin, the substantia nigra. So these black cells die off, but we now know, after many years of research, that these abnormal proteins and this degeneration appears in multiple circuits. And getting back to my last point, perhaps that's a reason why it's such a complex disease with so many of these motor tremor stiffness, slowness, and non-motor depression, anxiety, sexual dysfunction, blood pressure dysregulation. Perhaps it's because we see degeneration in multiple areas.
Ray Dorsey, about a minute to a break here. I just want to get up to speed on when we first knew about Parkinson's disease. It sounds like we got it with the Industrial Revolution. Give us a sketch on its discovery, diagnosis, and naming.
Yeah, so Dr. James Parkinson was a 62-year-old surgeon in London in 1817 when he saw six people largely walking the streets of London with a disease that he said had not been classified in the medical literature. They all had a stooped posture, a tremor, and a shuffling gait. He called it a shaking palsy, and then a French neurologist later called it Parkinson's disease. I don't think it's a coincidence that Parkinson's disease, a major description, came at the height of the Industrial Revolution in 1817 and in its capital, London, where the London fog had little to do with weather, everything to do with air pollution, and numerous studies have linked air pollution and other products and byproducts of the Industrial Revolution to Parkinson's disease since that time.
All right. This is a good place for us to pause because we're getting into some deep subject matter here, and there's a lot more to talk about with our guests, Ray Dorsey and Michael Okun. This is the book, Ending Parkinson's Disease, subtitled A Prescription for Action, and it does indeed include that. And there is a plan here for ending Parkinson's disease. It is not just the title of the book. We'll come back and talk more with our guests. They are two of the four authors of the book. We don't have with us Todd Shearer and Bastian Blohm today, but you can join the conversation on the Exchange. You might have questions about Parkinson's disease, maybe experiencing it yourself. We'd love to hear from you. 800-838-3760 on the phone, or send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Back with Ray Dorsey, Michael Okun, and Ending Parkinson's Disease on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. I'm glad you're listening. We have two of the four authors of the book Ending Parkinson's Disease, A Prescription for Action with us today. Ray Dorsey is a professor of neurology at the University of Rochester, the former director of the Parkinson's Division at Johns Hopkins University. Michael Okun is a professor of neurology at the University of Florida and is also the national medical director of the Parkinson's Foundation. So some heavyweights among this team, Todd Shearer, Bastian Blohm, the other authors of the book, not joining us today, but you can join the conversation as we talk about Parkinson's disease and one of the scourges of aging we anticipate and what can be done to push us toward getting better treatments and ultimately something that would stop it altogether. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Ray Dorsey, back to the history story. James Parkinson discovered these people with palsies in London. The name was applied by a French doctor, as you pointed out. He didn't have, James Parkinson, the whole picture. Who figured out the dopamine angle?
So that was identified by a Swedish neuroscientist, Arvid Carlson, in the 1950s, who, along with others, identified that the brains of people with Parkinson's disease have less dopamine, a chemical that allows nerve cells to communicate with one another, than individuals without Parkinson's disease. And that, as Michael suggested, led shortly thereafter to the development of levodopa, the most effective medication for Parkinson's disease, and still, which has allowed people to regain lots of their function. I want to just correct one thing. You refer to Parkinson's as the scourge of aging. I don't think it's the scourge of aging. It turns out that lung cancer also increases with age, but we don't consider lung cancer a scourge of aging. We consider lung cancer a scourge of smoking. And I want people to think about Parkinson's disease, for a lot of people and the majority of individuals, as a scourge of environmental risk factors that we're allowing to pollute our air, water, and food.
Well, and specifically, you point out there's a link from Parkinson's disease to TCE, trichloroethylene, and how has the EPA responded to concerns about TCE's abundance in various situations?
Yeah, so TCE, or trichloroethylene, is a widely used industrial solvent developed in the 1920s, initially used in dry cleaning, then found in everything from Senka coffee to whiteout to carpet cleaners, used as a degreasing agent. Contaminates up to 30% of groundwater in the United States, including, as I turned out, in Rogue Valley, Oregon. There is a contaminated wells on the Rogue Valley Highway in Oregon from the 1970s, 80s, 90s, and even to the present, to at least the 2000s, where people in Rogue Valley have been drinking TCE-contaminated groundwater and perhaps exposing themselves, increasing their risk to Parkinson's disease by 500%. And increasing their risk for cancer as well.
You guys,
the EPA has yet to ban it.
That was my next question. Because I know from talking to people at the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality decades ago who said, oh, that TCE, it's a bad actor, but it is still out there.
Yeah, it's still out there. There are still uses per permitting for degreasing and spot dry cleaning. Other countries in Europe, for example, have banned the chemical. United States has yet to do so. We're living with the sequelae of this pollution, and we're continuing to pollute by using it in the United States and in many parts of the world.
In the countries that have banned TCE, are there any particular changes in prevalence of diseases like Parkinson's?
So it's hard to say, but in the book we highlight that in the Netherlands, where Dr. Bas Bloem is from, it appears that the incidence, the number of new cases of Parkinson's adjusted for age, is decreasing. It's worth noting that Netherlands has among the cleanest air in all of Europe, was among the first countries to ban TCE and has low levels of TCE in the air, and was among the first countries to ban many of the pesticides that have been linked to Parkinson's disease.
All right, so let's talk about some of the remedies then. We already talked about levodopa as a treatment that has been in use for a long time now. And Michael Okun, when Arvid Carlson presented his research on levodopa, what was the initial reaction?
Yeah, so it's a pretty interesting story, and, you know, as we see in a lot of medical research and when people, you know, show their findings, there's skepticism that comes with that. And I think Arvid Carlson saw that skepticism, and there were a lot of early studies, and he studied rabbits, and he looked at dopamine-depleting drugs, and he had to really go through a series of experiments to show the importance of dopamine. And then later on, it was the field that took that information and really made it actionable. And so there was this fellow named George Kotsias in the early late 1960s, who then, you know, began giving dopamine, you know, so dopamine to actual persons with Parkinson. And remember, there wasn't a place for people with Parkinson to go. So a lot of them ended up kind of in hospitals or asylum-like types of operations. And so, you know, Arvid Carlson began giving dopamine. And then you may have seen the movie Awakenings with Robin Williams, and that's post-flu Parkinson, so Parkinson caused by post-flu, where he was giving those folks dopamine and they were waking up. And so that was sort of the path from the discovery to moving into clinical practice. And let me just say, there's no other
disorder I can think of that where you give a medicine like dopamine and people go from stiff and slow and shaking and shuffling to on and looking, you know, normal, particularly early in the disease. And so it was a remarkable journey from the lab to the bedside.
Michael Okun and Ray Dorsey are two of the four authors of Ending Parkinson's Disease, A Prescription for Action. They're our guests on the Jefferson Exchange. You had just mentioned the Awakenings movie with Robin Williams. So let's get into the story of the sleeping sickness noticed during World War I, Michael. What was that about?
Yeah, so, you know, and people have talked about it. Again, it popped up in the news with COVID-19, where early on people got the illness, you know, and the virus, and they noticed they were fatigued, and a bunch of those people were sleeping, right? And so it brought back our memory. It jogged that memory of encephalitis lethargica, which was an entity called sleeping sickness, which could be associated with features that looked like Parkinson. And in fact, the flu epidemic itself and the exposure to flu and viruses has long been thought to be a risk factor for Parkinson. And there's been some research in this area. And of course, now we're interested as to whether or not COVID-19 will have that same risk. And one of the best stories and most entertaining stories that I love are two Harvard neurologists, Schwab and Poskansar, getting way out in front at a major medical conference, a major neurologic conference, and making this bet that appeared it was either in Life magazine or Time magazine. They made this bet. If anybody could bring them a Parkinson person from that wasn't from the flu epidemic, then they would give them a case of scotch. And after several cases of scotch, they gave that up because obviously it wasn't independent of just the flu epidemic, but it gives you an idea of how people get caught on different hypotheses in medicine.
Ray Dorsey, you've talked about some of the environmental factors, but there is a genetic component too, isn't there?
Yeah, so about 10 to 15% of individuals will have an identifiable genetic risk factor for Parkinson's disease. A very small portion, about 1%, will be purely due to genetic. For those other 10 or so percent, some of those genetic risk factors, mutations in a gene called LARC2 or GBA, have known interactions with environmental factors, so pesticides. So this could, for example, explain why certain people exposed to these pesticides or chemicals develop the disease and why some individuals do not. But again, for 85% of people, the vast majority of individuals with Parkinson's disease, they have no known identifiable genetic risk factor.
Okay, so some other environmental factors here. I did not expect there to be an inverse relationship to smoking. Tell us about what's going on there.
So don't smoke. Smoking is a good way to lose lots of life due to cancer and heart disease, but it turns out that individuals who smoke are about 40% decreased risk of developing Parkinson's disease. Unclear why. One thought is that Parkinson's, as we mentioned, loss of nerve cells that produce dopamine, which is responsible for reward centers in the brain, and it's possible that it's easier for people to quit smoking or they derive less satisfaction years before they develop the tremor as Parkinson's disease is unfolding. So it could just be that early features of Parkinson's disease are manifesting themselves in a lower propensity to smoke. Or it could be that nicotine could be helpful, although studies have suggested that's not the case. That smoking perhaps changes the coverings of our linings of our nose or the bacteria in our gut, where we think that many cases of Parkinson's disease begin. And two of the earliest features of Parkinson's disease are loss of smell and constipation, suggesting that might be a portal of entry for some of these environmental risk factors.
All right. With the environmental risk factors, the numbers on the use of pesticides and other chemicals, they're quite sobering as you present them in the book, Ray.
Yeah. So the worst offending agent is a pesticide called Paraquat, developed in the 1950s, considered the most toxic herbicide ever created. It kills the weeds that Roundup doesn't. Been used to commit homicide and suicide, and over 30 countries, including China, have banned the chemical, but the United States has not. In fact, about 30 days ago, the EPA reauthorized its continued use. It's used throughout the United States, including in Southern Oregon and Central California. Use of the chemical has doubled over the last decade and increased 20% for the last year, for which data are available. The pesticide increases your risk of developing Parkinson's disease by 150%.
Wow. So we are talking to two of the four authors of the book Ending Parkinson's Disease, A Prescription for Action, written by Ray Dorsey, Todd Shearer, Michael Oken, and Bastian Blohm, all of them MDs. Todd Shearer is a PhD, but we are talking to Ray Dorsey and Michael Oken. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we explore Parkinson's disease and the various contributing factors and treatments and potential for eliminating it. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. Michael Oken, you detail in the book campaigns for polio, HIV, AIDS, and breast cancer, among others. There are big campaigns to defeat all of these things. Has there been anything quite on that scale for Parkinson's disease?
Yeah, so it's a little bit of a sore subject for me because I've been, you know, so involved with advocacy for so many years, and I hate to criticize the efforts in advocacy, but when we were researching the book, we really went into details about what other diseases really did when they put together their campaigns. And so we looked at polio, we looked at HIV, and, you know, we saw these efforts, which included the Infantile Paralysis Foundation, FDR, Eddie Cantor, mailing dimes to the White House, which is awesome, right? You're actually not allowed to mail dimes to the White House or any money to the White House anymore, by the way, because we tried it. Ray and I tried it, and it's now not considered legal, so we thought about that. But you know, that was an awesome effort. HIV, same thing. You know, they in a very peaceful way, occupied the FDA building. They put a condom over Jesse Helms's house when saying that Helms is you know, an unsafe politician, you know, and so they put a condom over his house, and they made quilts, and you know, they raised their voices, and they were charismatic, and they were aggressive, and they did it in a way that was effective, and they got people's attention. And so, as much as I love Parkinson and love all the people I've worked with, and I've worked in advocacy for two decades, I think after writing the book, I would say we have areas where we can improve, and we really need to raise and amplify our voices. And as we wrote the book, a group called the PD Avengers, like capes on the Avengers, came together. They have a Twitter group, and now there's thousands of people signing a petition on ending PD. And that's the kind of thing we need to be. We need to be disruptive. And so that's kind of what we learned. And I think trying to put some of that into action will help to move the ball forward for Parkinson.
Back to the environmental factors, we have an email from a listener, Chris in Medford, Ray, who asks, is it true that Parkinson's is more prevalent in people with a farming background?
Individuals from rural areas, individuals who drink their water from private wells, about 40 million Americans don't get their water from city water, but from private wells on their property, are at much higher risk, between 75 and 150% increased risk for developing Parkinson's disease. Rural areas, you know, can be have their private wells contaminated by pesticide runoff from nearby farms, and those wells are infrequently checked and not subject to the Safe Drinking Water Act. In addition, those farms can be spraying pesticides in the air, and people can be inhaling these chemicals and bypassing the normal protective barriers for the brain and be damaging their dopamine-producing nerve cells.
All right. So well water, once again, one of the cruxes here. Let's take another phone call here from Sarah in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ray Dorsey and Michael Oken.
Hello.
Hi.
My question is about deep brain stimulation.
Mm-hmm.
It's a treatment that's being used for Parkinson's, particularly for people with tremor, but I'm interested to know whether the authors see deep brain stimulation expanded to other problems with Parkinson's that would extend people's lives, for example.
Okay, thanks for that, Sarah. Michael, would you take this up and let us know what it is and the results from it?
Sure. Well, you know, first, thank you for the question. Ray probably knows this is my area of research. We call neuromodulation, how the networks in the brain connect together. So our lab's been working on this for, you know, over two decades and looking at how these cells and areas in Parkinson, how they communicate with each other, how we can understand the language that they speak, and we can develop and continue to try to pioneer and to put out there technological solutions that are going to address symptoms. Now, to answer your question, What are we good at, I think, would be the starting point, and that's we're good at tremor. We're good at suppressing the extra movements you get from taking dopamine. We talked about dopamine, but if you take dopamine for a while, you can get these dance-like movements called dyskinesia. And then people with Parkinson's, it's really crazy, but after they've had Parkinson for a while, the medications start wearing off in between dosages. So imagine you take a dose, and then a couple hours later, it wears off. Deep brain stimulation is very good for that, and we call those on-off fluctuations. Where we haven't been awesome is in walking, talking, and thinking. So a lot of our efforts and other efforts of labs around the country have been to develop a better understanding and a more focused treatment for walking, talking, and thinking. And no one has proven in a human that deep brain stimulation actually changes the course of Parkinson, or it saves cells, which are called neuroprotection. But there are some tantalizing papers and things that we've seen that might suggest that it could, you know, actually change the course slightly and in a positive way. But I don't think that the data is quite there. And so walking, talking, thinking is what we need to focus on. It doesn't really make the Parkinson go slower in terms of its progression, but it's very powerful on many of the symptoms.
Ray Dorsey, you get stuck close to a break again. Just a quick question about the EPA response to the environmental concerns. I mean, is it slow to take action because it gets a lot of industry resistance?
That's a question for the EPA. In fairness, the EPA did ban a pesticide called chlorpyrifos, widely used on golf courses, mm-hmm. utility poles, and Washington State apples about a month ago, and that action will prevent millions of children from developing neurodevelopmental abnormalities and prevent thousands of Americans from ever developing Parkinson's disease.
All right. Ray Dorsey and Michael Okun, two MDs, two of the four authors of the book Ending Parkinson's Disease, A Prescription for Action. We have much more to talk about, and we'll be more than happy to take your phone calls and emails with your concerns, your comments, your questions at 800-838-3760 on the phone, or send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Back to talk more about some preventive measures and some treatments as we continue to talk about Ending Parkinson's Disease with Ray Dorsey and Michael Okun. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. I'm glad you're listening. We're talking about Parkinson's disease, which our guests this hour say is growing faster now than cases of Alzheimer's disease. Parkinson's disease, with its tremors, slow movements, stiffness, issues with balance, and a bunch of potential contributing factors, including a lot of environmental ones, listed in the book Ending Parkinson's Disease, A Prescription for Action by Ray Dorsey, Todd Shearer, Michael Okun, and Bastian Blum. You can join us as we talk to Ray Dorsey from the University of Rochester and Michael Okun from the University of Florida, 800-838-3760. Email is jx@jeffnet.org. We've talked about the environmental factors. Haven't talked about head trauma yet, and Muhammad Ali is probably the best known example. Michael, tell us how much this figures into cases of Parkinson's.
Yeah, so, thanks for that question. And, you know, I also note that public TV has a really nice special running now on Muhammad Ali, and it raises our awareness, you know, again, about this issue of head trauma and Parkinson's. And so we actually were not sure when I started and when Ray started in the field, to be completely honest with your listeners, we weren't sure head trauma was related to Parkinson and to neurodegenerative diseases. But now, fast forward, we didn't see one study. We've seen multiple studies. And same thing that Ray talks about with pesticides. If you're someone in the public, you don't want to just see one study. You want to see multiple studies so you can believe it. We believe the pesticides are associated with a later increased risk of Parkinson. We now believe in the same way that hitting your head and head trauma is also associated with Parkinson's and degenerative disorders. And so that is super important. Now, one little tidbit for the listeners here is that it's not clear that Muhammad Ali's Parkinson's disease was due to being punched and what we call punch drunk in boxers. And it's a pugilistica syndrome that people have assumed that he had, but he actually had a early onset as a young man, symptoms of Parkinson. And there could have been a secondary effect from the trauma of, you know, being hit in the head, which is not, you know, awesome, you know, in terms of this, but he had a dopamine responsive early onset Parkinson disease syndrome, and that is most likely not, you know, the genesis of his problems, although it may have added to them. And so it's really important for us to ask those difficult questions and to sort these issues out.
Well, let's talk some responses, then we can talk about some preventive care. Tell us about Jimmy Choi, if you would, Ray, and his early diagnosis and how he changed his response.
Yes, so there was a famous French neurologist, Sir William Gowers, who in the late 1800s said that the life of people with Parkinson's disease should be quiet and sedentary. Well, they didn't meet Jimmy Choi. Jimmy Choi has been on America Ninja Warrior several times, and he has Parkinson's disease. And he commented, as we describe in the book, that when he initially got Parkinson's disease, he was depressed and withdrawn, and ceased to do much in the way of activity, but he changed his life around. He adopted exercise, is incredibly fit, and incredibly strong advocate for the Parkinson's community, and is living, you know, a robust and full life with his Parkinson's disease, despite having it at an early age.
So the phrase force exercise jumps off the page. Who does the forcing, and with what results?
So forced exercise is a new technique, been principally evaluated in bicycling, which has been shown to be helpful for people with Parkinson's disease. And with forced exercise, you do a bicycle in tandem, and the physical therapist, for example, pedals at a faster rate than you can do on your own. And there's some suggestion from animal studies and others that this forced exercise might be beneficial to people with Parkinson's disease.
Let's take a phone call here. Madeline in Ashland, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ray Dorsey and Michael Okun, two of the authors of Ending Parkinson's Disease.
Yes, my question has to do with neuroplasticity of the forced exercise. You mentioned the tandem bicycle with a physical therapist behind it, but some of us have found that having stationary bicycles in a class with a coach trained in spinning techniques for Parkinson's, some of us are experiencing a slowing down in the progression of our disease because of the spinning exercise we're doing, and also some rock steady boxing kind of things that we're doing. Like there's a group in Ashland that's doing that, and several of us are actually seeing a slowdown in our progression, and surprisingly, after 10 to 12 years of diagnosis, don't look much more different than somebody after a couple years of diagnosis. Mm-hmm. Do you have any comments about neuroplasticity and how that's working?
All right. Thanks for sharing the stories and asking the question, Madeline. Good to hear from you. Ray, why don't you take it?
Yeah.
Michael's going to take this.
Okay.
Yeah, this is a little bit in my area of brain circuitry. It's what a great question. You know, it turns out that there is this really tantalizing thing that happens when we do animal experiments in the laboratory with exercise, you know, and we put animals on little treadmills. We have these little things that we can experiment with and see what happens. And we get these really huge either neuroprotective effects, that means effects to stop cells from dying, or we get, you know, alternatively, improvements in the behavior of the animal. When we go to try to replicate that in humans, it's much harder. And it turns out, and to answer your question, it turns out it's much harder to show that that actually happens in humans. But we have many people who exercise a lot religiously, and their symptoms get better with their Parkinson. And in fact, we recently wrote reviews for both the Journal of the American Medical Association and for Lancet, you know, talking about, you know, where is the state of the art for Parkinson treatment? And now all the experts, based on the data, are recommending exercise. The leap that we're not willing to take yet is that it actually changes disease progression, meaning that we still believe that it has a powerful symptomatic effect. But we haven't been able to show it's neuroplastic, which was your question, plasticity, that it's changing the brain in a way that's actually slowing the disease down. There are many experts who believe that it is, but I don't want to misrepresent them because the data is not there yet to make that claim. So it's a terrific question.
Well, exercise tends to come up when we talk about any physical condition and diet right along with it, which we haven't talked about yet. Are there any foods that appear to help slow the progression, to help in any way, really?
So there's a Mediterranean diet that's low in animal products, high in fruits and vegetables that has been shown to decrease your risk of developing Parkinson's disease and may be beneficial for people with the disease. Since writing the book, I buy a lot more organic. I wash all my fruits and vegetables, and I put a carbon filter, like from Pure or whatever you want, on my water so that I get decreased exposure to pesticides and chemicals. I think this is really important even for people with the disease, because by the time you get Parkinson's, you know, 50 to 60% of those dopamine-producing nerve cells have died off, and you really want to protect the ones that you have by exercising, as the previous caller suggested, and by avoiding other nerve toxins.
And apparently coffee lovers rejoice there's a caffeine benefit?
Yes, so it appears that caffeine can decrease your risk of ever developing Parkinson's disease and might be beneficial for people with the disease, equivalent to about 1 to 4 cups of caffeinated coffee a day. We think it's the caffeine and not the coffee.
Okay. We have talked about the general level of attention to it that we haven't had some of the big campaigns. People haven't nailed dimes to the White House, as Michael pointed out, for Parkinson's disease. But Michael, how does the lack of attention to Parkinson's disease affect individual cases and just getting a good diagnosis?
It's huge. It's absolutely huge. And, you know, when we look at this, we realize that there's actually quite a delay in getting the right diagnosis, and particularly for people who present without tremor, because everybody thinks Parkinson has to have tremor. People don't think Parkinson occurs in young people. And in my clinic, I have people in their teens all the way up to centenarians, and so it can occur in any age. And there's many different, what we call in science, phenotypes. That's how people look. They can look quite different, and that's very confusing to docs. And so even getting the right diagnosis and realizing you have Parkinson is quite an issue, you know, in the field, and one that, you know, is deeply concerning for us. We've been working at the Parkinson's Foundation, you know, on just this issue, because it really does affect everything about what comes next in the public health sector.
We have a question here from Ethan, no town given, asks not about Parkinson's itself, but essential tremor, and asks if head trauma, well water, and rural living all have a similar relation to essential tremor.
I don't know the answer to that. Essential tremor tends to run much more in families than Parkinson's disease, and I'm unaware of any studies linking pesticides to essential tremor, but I didn't devote 2 years to writing a book on the topic. The big thing about essential tremor that differentiates it from Parkinson's disease is that in Parkinson's disease, a tremor occurs in the hands, usually at rest. In essential tremor, it usually occurs when someone's doing something, anything from drinking a glass of water to putting on makeup. or to shaving. It's tends to be far less progressive a disorder than Parkinson's disease and far less of a deadly disorder than Parkinson's disease.
So let me ask a compound question here about treatments, pharmacological treatments. Is levodopa still the primary, and has the development of new drugs been retarded a bit by the lack of funding and attention to Parkinson's?
Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, why don't you start, Ray, and I'll jump in.
Sure. So I'd go yes and yes. So levodopa is still the most effective medication for Parkinson's disease. And yes, therapeutic development has been retarded. We had more therapeutic breakthroughs for Parkinson's disease, levodopa, and deep brain stimulation from the 20th century, than we've had in the 21st century. I said at the outset that the number of Americans with Parkinson's disease has increased 35% in the last 10 years. If you look at funding from the National Institutes of Health for Parkinson's disease, one, it's low. It's about $250 million. And two, it has an increase, and adjusted for inflation, has actually decreased in the last 10 years. Same time, the number of Americans with the disease is increasing 30%. Funding from NIH is actually decreasing.
And there's an item on your action plan. Listen up, Big Pharma. This is a great business opportunity. So you really think there's a chance for them to, well, particularly with the numbers of people who are in a position to get Parkinson's disease in the near future, we think this would be a good business opportunity.
Oh, absolutely. And the reality is, and I agree with what Ray said, and I'd like to take it even one step further. We mailed carts to the White House in a campaign, part of our Ending Parkinson's Disease campaign, calling for an increase in 10 times the amount of funding per year. You know, these diseases, HIV and others, took the equivalent of $3 billion a year to move the needle. And this is a disease that is, so important and growing faster than Alzheimer's disease. It's going to swallow Medicare. It's going to swallow, us financially and affect economies across the world. And we're piddling around, with it. We've got to increase, the amount that we spend on it by at least tenfold per year to have a shot at moving the needle. And so when we talk about pharma, we're talking about pharma, sure. We're talking about National Institutes of Health. We're talking about foundations. We're talking about personal philanthropy funds. We got to do more.
We're done. Go ahead.
Michael had said that we need an Operation Warp Speed for Parkinson's disease. NIH funding $250 million. Michael J. Fox Foundation estimated that the annual economic burden of Parkinson's disease is $50 billion, 100 times greater. We're not going to get to the therapeutic breakthroughs we need at the current rate.
Well, okay, so that leads right into what was going to be the final question, which is, I wonder what lessons you might be drawing from the pandemic and its response on both the medicine, public health end, and in the public response.
So I'll start, and then I'll let Michael get the final word. We've learned that the way to handle COVID is to prevent the disease from ever happening. We don't have any cures for COVID, even 2 years into this pandemic, but we can certainly prevent the disease by vaccines and by changing our behavior. And it's far, far, far easier to prevent a disease than to treat it. I'd rather be never develop cancer than be cured of it. And we can prevent millions of people around the world from ever developing Parkinson's disease if we clean our air, if we stop using certain pesticides, and we eliminate industrial chemicals like trichloroethylene.
And Michael, you get the last 30 seconds.
Yeah, I'll just say, we wrote an op-ed on this for the Daily Beast, and look at what we did when we all came together on COVID. Look at all the science, look at all the innovation, look how fast we were able to do it, and that's why we called for an Operation Warp Speed. If we come together and we pool our resources, we can move the needle. We just have to make up our minds that that's the direction we're going to go.
The book is called Ending Parkinson's Disease, A Prescription for Action by Ray Dorsey, Todd Shearer, Michael Okun, and Bastian Blohm. Our guests have been Ray Dorsey from the University of Rochester and Michael Okun from the University of Florida. Thank you so much for joining us today, both of you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Torres, for the interview.